This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. We want to thank each and every one of you listeners for tuning in from week to week and listening to the Magic Word Podcast. We know you have a lot of other options of things that you could be doing with your time, whether it's watching something on television or streaming from Netflix or other podcasts that are out there, and so many distractions and diversions. And I hope that what we have to offer you each week is something that you enjoy and something that brings you back and wanting to learn more, because I want to kind of go back, I guess, and explain what the purpose is of this whole podcast, just to actually have a conversation with friends of mine and also for me to learn something. This goes back actually many years ago, whenever that I used to work with the Magic Island here in Houston, and every week we would have a roundtable luncheon, and whoever happened to be in town would join us for lunch, and we sat down, had a great conversation, and I got to learn a lot about what these guys were doing, and not necessarily just about magic, although there was a lot of that that came about, and we would talk about philosophies and theater and audience volunteers and handling hecklers and golly, you know, what all. And as a result of that, I started writing a column that I call Scott's Thoughts that was promoted and published throughout the world, literally across the United States and in other foreign countries then as well. And it ran for about 7 or 8 years on a monthly basis that I would put these things out long before the internet. In fact, I remember even faxing things or sending out what used to be called floppy disks to some people. Anyhow, they were just kind of the results of these conversations that we had. Well, as technology had evolved, that's whenever that we came about starting to use the platform of podcasts in order to help share some of these ideas that I had. Whenever that I discuss these things with people, ideas that come up in the course of a natural conversation that have to do with creativity, theater, and a lot of theory, as well as just the fun conversations of getting to know each other better. So throughout all these past 500 plus episodes that we've had, there are just a lot of people that we've talked to with a lot of really great information that they have imparted to us, and it's been really a lot of fun. Well, I'm going to mention this one other thing that I'm just going to say at once. I'm trying to keep this podcast somewhat generic from the standpoint that recognizing that right now we're going through a difficult time here in 2020 with a pandemic, but I don't want to dwell on the negative on that. In fact, that these episodes on the podcast I want to keep very timeless, if you will, so they will be just as relevant in 2030 as they are in 2020. So if we are not discussing things that are happening in real time during these episodes, there's a reason for that, because I don't want people coming back in the future and going through the archives and listening to one of these episodes and saying, that reminded me of a very bad time in my life. I don't want to hear the rest of what they have to discuss. So we don't get into those kinds of things, but we talk about things, again, that I believe are important and maybe theoretical, maybe a development of acts or whatever that can still, again, be just as relevant in the future as they are in the present. If you want to hear more about what's going on with the magicians and how that we are handling the current situation, then I would encourage you to go to either my Facebook page at Facebook/TheMagicWordPodcast or go to my YouTube channel at Scott Wells Magic. And there from week to week, that on Thursday nights, we have a virtual happy hour, Magic and Martini happy hour, where I have for the last 17 or 18 weeks have been featuring several guests. I have 3 people at a time, and I host this and we'll take questions live at the time and recognize people who are coming on online and saying hello to them and answering those questions. But we have a variety of guests, many of whom have been guests on the podcast in the past. And here is where we have an opportunity to discuss today's news. And I believe it is fresh, just as fresh as today's news is, with the understanding that that tomorrow is therefore that what we talked about this past week may be as old as yesterday's news. So we try to keep that very current on the video stream that we do when we do that live. If you don't get an opportunity to join us live there, you can always go back and watch it at your convenience, either on my YouTube channel at Scott Wells Magic or on the Facebook page. Those are kept on the on the page as well, so you can watch those at any other time. Again, I just wanted to mention that one time and then be done with it, so this way that you know that there are some options if you want to kind of know what's happening currently in the lives of many of magicians right now. Go and check that out and listen to some of those past episodes and join us live if you can. And all the information is there on Facebook and on YouTube. So there you go. And so this week, we are talking with a guest that was with us a few weeks ago when we were talking about the secrets of the contest for FISM, or the World Championships of Magic. And we had three guests, one of whom was Boris Wilde. And I thought certainly that the conversation we had there was short enough that certainly warranted a longer and more in-depth discussion with Boris about his act of the KISS Act and his Butterfly Act and his development of that and working at FISM, et cetera. He's a great guy and is much loved around the globe for his act and just a charismatic fella and just a lot of fun to talk to. He's got a Mark deck that is wonderful, and he developed the KISS count. Anyhow, just a lot of things that he's developed. Very creative gentleman and a good friend and someone I know that you're going to enjoy. So please welcome my guest this week, Mr. Boris Wilde, here on The Magic Word. I'm excited today to talk with a friend from across the Atlantic, a good friend of mine that I see regularly at Obie's 4F convention. It's hard to say Fechter's Finger Flicking Frolic, but a little at a time, that's kind of changed over the years. But this is a magician who has attended many times. In fact, speaking of the 4F, he was a guest of honor, actually, at the 4F convention. In addition to that, of course, he was a French champion of magic back in 1996. He was a FISM world champion then as well. He created the KISS Act and the KISS Count back in the early 2000s. He's been featured on the cover of many magazines. I know that some of you have seen him at other conventions and lecturing and perhaps own some of his stuff, like his Mark deck, which is phenomenal. Please welcome my friend from Paris, France. Here he is, Mr. Boris Wilde. Hey, Boris.
Hey, bonjour, Scott.
Oh, there, say it again.
Bonjour.
Bonjour.
Hello, everyone.
I love that. I love that. Hey, so listen, you are in Paris. Is that right? I mean, kind of near downtown?
Yes,
absolutely.
Okay.
Mm-hmm, yes. I'm assuming that's kind of, I've been to Paris, but it's been a very long time. So how close, like, near the downtown area do you reside?
I don't, like, live, like, right in the heart of Paris. I'm just a little outside, which is nice because that's, I can
sure.
Very conveniently, you know, go, like, really in the heart of the city, but still hear the birds singing and not coughing in the morning. So that's good.
That's good, yeah. You can go down to the bistro if you want to or whatever. After Notre Dame had burned, that was a tragedy. And I'm just curious, what's been going on with, I mean, it's nothing to do with magic. I'm just kind of curious, what's been happening with that of late? Are they still trying to design something or what's happening?
The goal is that they want to have the Notre Dame completely like rebuilt for the Olympics in Paris.
Mm-hmm. What year will that be? What year will the Olympics be there?
I think it's in 2024 now, I think. I'm not even sure.
Yeah, okay.
So I'm not following pretty much the sport, but I know that people say that it would maybe take like a decade or whatever. I mean, it's going to be super long because, of course, the damage was very, very serious. But they were like, okay, if we really want to have it ready for the Olympics. Problem now is that with COVID and everything, it just delayed any major, construction like this one here.
Sure.
So I'm not really sure when it's going to be ready, but, we had like some very wealthy people that were like loving the arts and loving architecture and history, etc. Just, gave lots of money just to make sure that Notre Dame doesn't, disappear, doesn't collapse or anything. So it's on the way. I mean, now they have like... all kind of stuff around the
scaffolding,
the building. Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. So they can just, you know, and they started, of course, again, since we're not on lockdown anymore, they started again taking care of it, which is great.
Right, right. Well, speaking of Paris and thinking about other kinds of European things, one of the things that I did not mention, by the way, I said, of course, that you were a past FISM winner, but not only that, had served as a judge for FISM and currently the, the head of the jury then right now. Can you address a little bit about that and kind of what that entails? What do you do as the head of the jury?
Yeah, well, I have been lucky to be a judge at FISM at first. That was my first experience was in 2006 in Stockholm. And I mean, really enjoyed it. And I guess they were happy with what I did because 3 years later, FISM was in China, Beijing. And they, you know, they asked me to be chairman of the jury for Close Up. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, so I had to sign the paper that says, yeah, the new world champion of Close Up Magic is. Da-da-da. So that's quite a big responsibility, a big task, I would say. But it was exciting and, yeah, a great experience. And after that, I became an official FISM judge. And so that's why now anytime they need, like, an official FISM judge in a competition somewhere. So, yeah, they can ask me to do it, which is great. I mean, I really enjoy doing it because it's a different way to look at an act because, of course, you're looking for things that can, you know, make magic better for the future. And I, you know, in terms of originality, of course, but presentation. And then we can see lots of acts mixing different arts like juggling and magic and mime. And that's really cool to see that. Mm-hmm. That makes quite a big difference compared to, you know, when I was competing like back in the day, like 20 years ago or so. We can see the magic evolving, and it's also nice to be part of the judging process to, you know, put the spotlight on the people that we know, you know, perform in the future. So that's pretty cool.
Now, do judges actually sit down with the acts afterwards and talk with them, or can they have the option to come to you, or are they not supposed to talk about to each other, or what?
Oh, yeah, well, basically the judging process is, of course, everybody comes on stage, we put some scores, and in the end we just talk together between all judges, and we decide, of course, we'll be the third, second, first, and there's a Grand Prix, of course, at FISM too. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty much how it goes. But first, I mean, FISM has evolved a little bit because in the past it used to be like that. Now we just take the best ones in each category, and they just perform again on the last day in the finals, and then we have to decide only between like a couple of people who will be the Grand Prix, which is the world champion. And once all this process is over, obviously, yes, I mean, lots of competitors like to just come to you to see the judge, especially the head of the jury or any judge they know, and just, you know, ask for feedback. And I'm always, you know, happy to give feedback to people because I think it's, I mean, scores are numbers, it's fine. But and we need that, obviously. But feedback and being able to talk and maybe address some issues, or, you know, say, hey, that was good, but maybe you can improve on this and that, because we're looking at specific criteria. That's, I think, a nice and a very constructive way for people, I guess, to improve their act. So I've been always happy to talk to competitors after.
Yeah, like when you're saying that you need to move magic forward, the best way is for people to not only come with their best act, but then also to see how they can improve it if they did not win, if someone else did.
Yep.
And so if you don't ask questions, really it's not going to move forward. And if you don't offer good advice, it's not going to move forward then either. It could, you know, move backwards. So you're saying really there is not a scheduled time. It's just something that if the performers wish to seek out that advice from the judges, they should initiate that themselves.
Yes. I mean, they have some feedback after the competition. It's just, I mean, we can't like make like a 20-page, you know, book with every detail, everything.
Sure.
So they have like guidelines, and they have like the, you know, the big things, especially like, okay, I mean, it's a great act. Sleight of hand is amazing, this and that, but it lacks originality. So you should work on that particular aspect. And so they have like some, you know, major points about the act. And then, of course, later, yes, I mean, they're welcome. And, you know, it's totally fine to go and see the judge and talk with them. It usually happens the last day of FISM after the award ceremony, and that's usually where we always, you know, we're around for them.
What is the position of FISM as far as any of the judges actually acting as a teacher or mentor or director for someone who is going to compete? Do they have to recuse themselves and step out if rather than judging them, or they can't do that at all? In other words, if I was going to be competing in FISM and I had won at the Continental Championships and qualified, and then I said, okay, I'm going to go to talk to Boris about my act. I want you to help fine-tune this even more. Mm-hmm. Could you do that, or what happens?
Well, the thing is that the way now, I mean, the official way and the best way to get to FISM, to the World Championship of Magic, it's first to do a national competition. So you can move up to the FISM Continental Championship, which happens, you know, North America, South America, Europe, Asia, and that's the best way, because then after that, if you win there again, you get the golden ticket to go to FISM. And in that process, obviously, if you have, like, you know, friends and, like, people, mentors and, like, famous magicians that can help you, that's a natural thing to, you know, go to them and talk about that. As a judge, I mean, it depends. I've done it several times, but if I know it, like, quite far in advance, and if I have, like, a good friend of mine talking to me and says, hey, can you, and I'm like, I'm a judge, so I don't think it's gonna be fair. I don't think I'm in a good position for, you know, me to help you in that thing. But like I'm French. David Stone is one of my good friends. He's also French, and he was at a competition in 2006 in Stockholm, and I had to judge him, and he's one of my buddies. So yeah. I mean, that's a difficult task, honestly, because I've not been involved in any way in his act. He worked on his act, and I wanted to really stay away from that. So I basically discovered the act when he just performed in front of me in the competition. But I'm there as a judge. So whether he's my buddy or not, I mean, I just, you know, I blank my mind, and sure. I'm just seeing and I'm judging the person that I have in front of me, and, you know, sure, just like everyone else. I mean, it's...
You have to be objective. Then, mm-hmm.
Absolutely, yes. And usually, and even after, because, you know, once we have meetings regularly and we talk about the acts, and whenever I have like an act like him, I step away. I'm like, okay, he's one of my friends, so I don't want to be, you know, seen as, you know, mm-hmm. either helping him or not helping him at all. I'm just trying to be fair. So, of course, I'm talking. And of course, I'm being part of the discussion, but if there is like some kind of issue or something, then you want to talk or something to, I'm like, yep, I'm not. I don't want to be part of that.
Well, to a degree, I would think that judges would be friends to some degree or another with most of the competitors, because it's a small community, a small fraternity. We know each other pretty well. And so some better than others. And that if you're going to be judging someone, then it's difficult to say you have an ugly child to someone, for an example.
Yeah.
Because you are good friends, and that is the problem. I know, like at the Texas Association of Magicians many years ago, that they had decided that the judges should be kept secret. That is, particularly the stage judges from the competitors, mm-hmm. so this way that they can judge more efficiently without fear or repercussion, let's say, of a parent, let's say for a junior competition, coming mm-hmm. back and saying to so-and-so, hey, we're buddies, how come that you were so harsh on my child? Or they didn't get first place or whatever, and they might lose relationships or friendships, you know, in such a small, tight-knit community within a local or regional convention. FISM is a little bit different. It's a lot different. Obviously, it's on a world scale and a lot more people, but still, we are friends, and
be. Mm-hmm. It's still the same, honestly, because when I judged, it was more than 10 years after I won. So in the meantime, I did several FISM where I lectured and performed and of course traveled the world and went to other conventions. So it was just funny just to sit behind the table and see people in front of me. And I'm like, oh, I worked with that guy at this convention. Oh, I know him. Oh, he's my buddy. Oh, that. But, mm-hmm. I mean, it's, yes, of course, it's, as you say very rightly, it's a small world. But when they're there, it's FISM, and you have to be absolutely, you know, in your seat, in your shoes of the judge. And you just, yeah, You just see what you see here, and you're like, you don't have to think, oh yeah, I mean, I've seen him better. And like, no, you've never seen him before. I mean, you have to, he's pretty much Men in Black. You have to do this thing with the Men in Black and choom, and you just mm-hmm. splash and forget everything. You judge the person in front of you. And I mean, that's it. So, and yes, of course, obviously, sometimes if that person that you, it might not be a friend, but an acquaintance or someone you may have met like once in your life, like a few years ago, a few years before, and you had a good feeling and it was fun when you were backstage with him because you were performing. And then he just, you know, it's not that great on that day because, you know, we had some bad days. And obviously the scores are not too high. And of course, that guy didn't get anything, and it's pretty hard. And my friends who were judged before me says, Boris, if you accept to be a FISM judge, you're gonna lose some friends, or you're gonna lose some acquaintances or people around you. So be sure that you're ready for that. I'm like, okay, I don't like it, but hey, fair enough. And it happens. And it's, I get some people coming to me mad at me after the award ceremony and being like, whoa. I was like, you know what? Even if I'm head of the jury, I'm only like 1/7 of the score. I don't have more power than anybody else. I'm just my score is the same as anyone else. I'm just signing the paper at the end.
I would suspect that when you were competing, you said 20 years ago or so, that you probably knew some of the judges and may have had a similar kind of a feeling. It's like, well, this guy was my friend. How come he was so harsh in judging me? I thought I did a better act than that.
It didn't happen to me, honestly, because back in the day, I didn't really travel. I mean, I did a few things in Europe before, but like very close to France. But FISM was in Dresden, and at that time I was there in Germany. And I honestly, the judges that were there, I didn't really know them. So because I was really nobody. I mean, I just came from nowhere. Mm-hmm. With that act that I just, you know, performed 1 year before the French Convention where I got the Grand Prix, and that was it. So, I mean, I really came from nowhere. So
when you say came from nowhere, I mean, was this something that you were inspired by? That was the KISS Act, is that right, that you had come up with?
Yes.
And how did that come about then? I mean, were you a member of a local magic club or saw some on TV? Or, I mean, that is such a different and out-of-the-box and revolutionary kind of an idea. I mean, you couldn't have seen someone do that. Obviously, that's why you won, because it is original, but...
It's been, honestly, I started Magic in 1985.
Oh, and also you might describe the KISS Act, by the way, because I know there are some listeners who are probably thinking, well, what's he talking about?
So. Sure, yeah.
So go ahead, sorry.
Very quickly, I started Magic in 85. I did a few competitions in the late 80s, early 90s in France and Belgium, and got awarded every time. I was very happy with that. And then I started to do, like, table hopping, close up, and like semi-professional because I was studying at the same time. And just before 96, that's when it happened, there's the French Championship of Magic. I was like, hey, I haven't done competition for a little while. Maybe I should try again just for fun because I had this idea. And at first, the idea I had came from a very simple thing. I was looking around me and I was looking at people doing close-up, especially card magic, and there were two things. They were talking a lot and they were doing much comedy. They were doing lots of comedy, lots of jokes and ha ha ha. Mm-hmm. And I remember one day I talked to someone and she said, oh yeah, we saw a magician last night. He was doing like you. He was doing close-up and blah, blah, blah. Oh, sure. So how was it? Oh my God, it was so funny. We had so much fun. Oh my God, his jokes were killing me. And I'm like, and they were basically talking about the comedy and not the magic.
Ah.
And I was like, damn it. I mean, that's that's not what I would like to hear about, you know, my performance. I mean, yeah, they could say, oh yeah, we had a good time. It was entertaining and blah, but everything was about the joke and being funny. I was like, ah.
And nothing to do with being mysterious. Or mystifying.
No. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Also, maybe it's because I'm French and I don't like to do what others people do and I don't follow the rules. I don't know. But I was like, okay, everybody is doing talking and making people laugh. I'm going to do a silent act and I will make them cry. So just for the challenge, I would say, just to say, okay, I won't do the opposite of everybody there, what everybody does. And I'm like, okay, so silent, no talking, so music. Okay, just music. No talking around music, just music. Okay. And cry. Oh, So, I mean, my goal was like, I come with a deck of cards, 7 minutes later, I finish, I look at people, and I can see little tears in their eyes. And I'm like, that's not going to be easy with just the deck of cards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to create emotion like that, that's amazing. That's what you want people to remember. That's great.
Yeah, exactly. And so I started to think, and I have this method to create an act, and one of the things that came very quickly, it's love. And I'm like, because it's universal, and everybody can relate to like love stories they may have in the past. And so I said, okay, well, I'm going to tell a love story with the deck of cards. And so what can I do? Maybe hearts. I'm like, oh, no, everybody's done that before. I mean, it's pretty cliche, hearts. Yeah. So, but I know I thought, okay, a first kiss. First kiss is like, we all had a first kiss, and it's a very special moment in your life. And the kiss is like very, it's something which is romantic and sexual and sensual at the same time. And it's like, it's something quite intimate, but at the same time that just, you know, describes perfectly, you know, the feeling you can have, you know,
it's when memorable.
You get kissed.
Something you'll
and
remember.
It's memorable. Mm-hmm. Exactly. I'm like, okay, maybe we should go for that. And basically that's how I created it. So the kiss act is, for those who don't know, it's I come with a blank deck of cards. A kiss appears, multiply. Those kiss travel. There's a picture of the lady. And it's basically like when you meet someone, okay, first, you know, you try to do like a little game of seduction, and then there might be a kiss, there might be several kisses, and it finishes by spreading the card, and there's a message on the card that says, I love you, and hopefully you get, you know, the answer you would like to hear, and she says, me too, and I finish with, you know, having the picture of the lady on my cheek, and there's a kiss appearing on my cheek, and I take it, and it multiplies into like hundreds of kisses and confetti flying in the air. Mm-hmm. And all done to music, so I'm not talking. And so that's pretty much the idea.
Well, part of that is trying to find the right music then also that is not, you're not going to have to pay for copyright fees and things like that, I would think. Is this something that was custom made for you, or how'd you find the right music?
No, I use the music that, you know, that was existing already. So like every time I was like, you know, like performing or doing TV, etc., like claiming the rights and everything. So that was important. But that music was just so powerful that I love music. So I really, really love music. So I always try to, whenever I hear some music, when I go to a movie theater and I hear music,
sure.
I love soundtracks. That's mm-hmm. where mostly I got my music. So, and I found that one, and I have like a playlist in my iPhone, and I have like, I don't know, dozens of music that I've never used. But when I hear those musics, I have shivers. I can feel something. And that's the key for me. That's
right.
The only way I would pick a music. I would pick a music if I feel something when I hear it, not knowing what I would do on it, just thinking one day, I will use it. And the day I will use it, I know I could express emotion easier, because it's not just a music. It's something I handpicked and that makes me feel something strong. So, and that's what happened with the Kiss Act, obviously. And at that time, it was quite, I mean, talking about music in close-up now, I mean, I know you got people, you know, from all generations listening to your podcast, Scott, but like younger people now, they're thinking, oh, he's doing a card routine to music. Yeah, just like so many people. But back in the day, when I was at FISM, it was 97, it was very, not strange, but it was very unusual. At FISM, I went to the tech guy with my CD, and I said, well, here is my music for my act later. And the guy was like, oh, no, stage competition is tonight.
Yeah.
And I'm like, no, I'm not doing stage. I'm doing close-up. And he says, then why are you giving me a CD?
Yeah.
I'm like, I give you a CD because I have music for my act. And he just took my CD, looking at me up and down, like, who is that? Who's that guy?
That's funny.
That tells you a lot about what music was happening in close-up at that time. In my session at FISM, I don't think there was anyone else using music. And if people were using music, because of course people were using music before me in close-up, but like often it was just a background music. They were like talking over, or there was just a piece to music, not like an entire act, like a stage act, entirely to music without talking. So that was what makes it different from the beginning, I think.
Yeah, so kind of what I hear you saying as far as someone who is either wanting to create an award-winning act or just an act that would appeal to an audience is, first of all, do something completely different from what everyone else has been doing.
Yeah.
Because you took the exact opposite. They were being funny. You wanted to be kind of sad or emotional, at least.
Emotional,
number two,
yeah.
You want to create an emotion, again, and a feeling with your audience so they will remember you in that act, which would, number three, separate you from everyone else who is just, that was a funny guy, I don't remember his name. It's like a cruise ship magician. I did this, this, and this, but I don't remember his name. Mm. But if you were able to cross, really break that fourth wall and really touch them in their hearts emotionally, they will remember you, not just the act, everything then
exactly.
too. And then finally, too, in your case, that you had done something different by using music, which, again, now a lot of people do. You know, Sean Farquhar has done that very successfully, speaking of cruise ships, you know, and on the big screen and whatever. And so many other people, of course, who are using music with their close-up. But there still has to be something else that you can do. I just saw a show about it this last year of Jamie Allen, who from the UK, and he was called a high-tech magician. I'd forgotten it, high-tech trickster or something. Anyhow, that the eye magician, I think that's what he goes by. And the idea is that he had a lot of things that were digital and things that can only be done with TV, but he had volunteers who were up there and interacting with them. Anyhow, he's kind of finding his own niche using technology known today. And so if you can transcend that, or, you know, perhaps use some of that or transcend that into something that no one else is doing, that again would separate you. And that's kind of what people saw apparently that year in 97 in Dresden when you had won that award. So, you know, that's good advice, all good advice.
You said two words that are very important. You said different and remember. And that's, I think, from what you just said here, that's what people and the listeners here should remember. And should take into account. Different, that's the key. Especially if you go to FISM. If you go to FISM and you're going to do a matrix with coins on the table, you can be sure, not 90%. You can be sure 130%. Then someone else will be there with another matrix. So it's going to be maybe there's a big chance it's going to be better than you. And because, he maybe worked harder, he just had like other ideas, etc. So if you go there, it has to be a magic. If you want to do magic, it has to be different. So different is the keyword. And remember is another keyword. As you said, people need to remember you. And especially if you, I take the analogy of whenever you go to a movie theater and you watch a movie, when you read a book, when you listen to a music, a song, an album, the after, I like the after. You
exit the credits, just listening to music.
No, I mean like you exit the movie theater it's over, and you're afterwards outside, and you're like, okay, where did I park my car? Was it? that's that way. Because you're still, you know, you still have all these feelings that you just, you know, you had during
the movie.
Well,
you just experienced the movie, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're still a little bit in it. When you finish a book, same thing. I mean, it takes a little while before you go back to reality in some way. And I was like, it has to be the same thing with a live performance, but especially with magic. I mean, I want people when it's over to still be like, whew, wow, okay, well, whew, right.
Right.
And I was really aiming for that. And when I started to do KSAC and I was looking at people at the end, and I could see some people like taking like their, you know, tissue paper, and they were like, you know, wiping their eyes. And one day I remember there was a guy that came to me after the show, says, "What did you do to my wife?" Like, oh my God, what did I, nothing?
Yeah,
what are you talking about? And he was pointing at her, and she had like pretty much like five or six like tissue paper crawled in the bowl on her lap. And she was like crying, and I was like, oh, I'm so sorry. And then she was like, yeah. But it was good crying. I mean, it was emotional crying. Mm-hmm. And the guy was just not mad at me. He was just like trying to making me have a hard time and just, you know, and says, look what you did to her. So I hugged her. We talked, and it was fun, obviously. But
sure.
He was just surprised that her wife was reacting that way to a card trick. It's not a card trick, but it's, you know, we can consider it as a, you know.
I've heard Penn Jillette talk about the same thing. It's important to have something that's going to be not just different, but emotionally and touch the people and relate to them. You were talking about something that's a matrix. You know that a lot of people are going to be doing a matrix and to do something very different.
Anything. Yeah, anything. You can have like nails, of course, like, you know, in a big piece of wood. And of course, you understand that those nails can't move because they are in the wood and then they move
that's
rather than
idea.
Coins that you can slide. Mm-hmm. Or I got this idea one day, like if you're like in a fancy restaurant and you have this very like fancy white tablecloth and you take some wine and you just pour a little wine in like four spots and
mm-hmm.
you can see, of course, like stains of wine on the thing. And then you put your hand over and they just move and you get the four stains of wine, you know, all gathered together at the same place. And then finally you just do something and they just disappear. Or, I mean, it's still a matrix, but if you do that, suddenly, like, okay,
yeah.
that's different. Different method and different thinking, original. Okay, that's cool.
I saw Alan Okawa do this many years ago, which several times, and he still fools me even thinking back to this. And Alan, being from Hawaii, used a, looked like a coral shell or something, basically, in which he essentially did a what's next type of a trick in which that he showed that it had a hole in it, you know, and then he would show both sides and go through it. And then there were two holes and then six holes, you know, I mean, four holes, you know, and then it's like, where did they come from? And then they disappeared. And he wasn't switching it. You know, it was just in some sort of a paddle move or I don't know exactly. I, you know, trying to think back and I cannot reconstruct it, but just fool the heck out of me, you know, using something that was unique to him and to his culture there in Hawaii and something mm-hmm. you would find on the beach. And it made sense. And it was just fantastic and mystical as well. It wasn't so much emotional, it was original and magical, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, as long as you get this feeling, as long as you get, people have feelings, it could be a feeling of mystery, like of pure emotion, or they are just stunned, or they have been scared. Because when we talk about emotion, most people think it's going to be something very poetic or romantic. But there are like all mm-hmm. kinds of emotions. And when that guy is in the big tank of water on stage, and you can see the clock ticking, and it's going to be like 10 seconds left before he's out of, you know, oxygen. And I mean, it's emotion too. You're like, whoa.
Interesting that you talk about that. I had a podcast recently with Jonathan Goodwin, who is one of the persons. It's in the UK in the Illusions Trap. Okay.
Oh, yes.
So, and I hadn't thought about this, but he said, you know, I like to imagine what it is that the audience is willing to believe. What you know, I don't want to stretch it beyond their beliefs, mm-hmm. but I want to imagine. In other words, that if you're going to get in a straitjacket, you know you're going to get out. If you're going to be hung upside down, you're going to get out. You're not going to be real in real danger, because are we going to see someone actually get killed here today? You know, kind of a thing. So that's why he would end up having his mouth taped shut and then pulls out, you know, well, in a straitjacket, then take a tape off and there's a scorpion in his mouth or whatever.
Scorpion, yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Those kinds of things, you know, that there is some danger involved, certainly, but it's a believable kind of a danger and not something mm-hmm. that it's like, okay, yeah, I know he's going to get out. The car's not going to crash into that and he's going to burn and die, you know, because he's done it three times already today, you know.
Yes.
So, you know, what can you do that's still going to be, you know, putting people on the edge of their seats, but to be believable, but not like, oh, this is really not going to happen. You know, I may as well be watching TV. So that you want people to be invested in it. There's a fine line, you know, so to mm-hmm. be able to identify that, you know, something
exactly.
that I thought that he was interesting to talk to about that.
Mm-hmm. Mm. It's same thing with emotion, because like whenever I do the Kiss Act, and then I release like the sequel of the Kiss Act, it's called the Butterfly Act. And the Butterfly is about lost love. And it's because there's been 10 years in between those two acts. And of course, I grew up, I become more mature, and I, mm-hmm. you know, and it's, I also needed to do a sequel that's different. And that would be maybe a little darker, because yeah, the first one is like more like about a meeting. And then the second one is like, yeah, well, you know, things happen in your life and, you know,
sure.
you can lose someone. And,
sure.
and in that act, I mean, I got lots, there was a fine line, and I kept that line, because at the end people were like, is it a true story, or is he telling his story with the cards, or is it just like a complete act that he's doing for us? And I got lots of people coming after me, like asking, well, is it something that you do? And whenever you're very touched at the end, is it because that you're talking about someone you lost? Or, and I'm like, It maybe, but we're doing what we're doing here is a performance. So I'm doing like pretty much like a, it's like a theater play, and mm-hmm. so using cards and I do magic. So, but you know, I will let you believe what you want to believe. And they're like, oh, okay. And it's the same thing. I mean, people are like, yeah, okay. They know it's not 100%, you know, my story, or I'm not doing that. But at the same time, it may be based on something true. They are not sure. And I like this line, just like, you know, when you said about danger. People know they want the guy will not die on stage, but still he's taking enough risk sure. that there might still be an accident or something dangerous, because it has happened right. in the past anyway. So yeah.
Right. Well, at the end of my stage show, sometimes I have presented a gypsy thread in which that I talk about my life and growing up, going to school, mm-hmm. getting married, having children, having grandchildren, then my wife passing, and all these different parts of your life. And then you keep hoping that certain things happen, but at the end you wish you had all those things back together, but all of them mm-hmm. make up your total life. And as I'm talking about that, I do get emotional, and the audience yeah, can sense course. That, and they also mm-hmm. learn more about me. So afterwards, they feel that they know me, and they can, a lot more people come to me after the show to say, oh, that was just lovely. You know, whether they talk about that piece or the rest of the show in total. Mm-hmm. But I'm often wondering, is that something I should do earlier in the show or use that as a close? I've always used that as a close because I don't think I could do it at the beginning and then continue the rest of the show.
You know? Yeah, I know. Yeah, it's a nice, no, it's just a nice way to end on a, if you want like something, if you want to finish on like an emotional piece, that's probably the best way to do, because you've been a performer, so you're very, you have to be professional, and you have to, you know, perform as the professional you are. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, it's always nice at some point in the show just to, you know, like unveil a little bit of you more as a person, right. as a human being. So talk about your story, because especially as magicians, you always get that question. Now, how did you start magic? How did you become a magician, et cetera, et cetera. So people like to know a bit more what is the background of a magician. So if you can offer them like spontaneously in your act, in your show, and especially if it, you know, relates something to your life, which is something personal and it's something mm-hmm. that really happened to you, people will obviously feel it. And that's the best way to do. And if you can, if you want to do an emotional piece on stage, it has to be linked to something that makes you feel something strong about. I mean, it has to be...
Right.
It's hard to fake it 100%. I mean, some people like actors and can do that in movies, and it's amazing. I don't know how they do that, but I... As a performer, it's easier to talk about your life when it's something that happened to you.
Now, the KISS act that you developed way back when, I assume that you probably had practiced and shown club members there locally. But where did you go and perform this after you had won, or maybe prior to that? I mean, obviously, this is something that has to be done over and over to get your timing down and everything. And I'm curious that as a close-up magician, I can do some strolling and practice my close-up things, whether I'm at a restaurant or a cocktail party, and I'm practicing mm-hmm. this, and I'm strolling around. Likewise, if I'm doing a stage act, I'm performing for a company or a banquet, or when we used to have the Magic Island here, perform there regularly, or maybe go to mm-hmm. the castle or whatever. My point is that the KISS act is a very unique act in which that you have to set and reset. It's not something that you can stroll with necessarily. No. You could do it table to table, but the reset would take a lot of time, plus the confetti type of hearts that you blow out and everything.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and the butterflies now and whatnot. That's not something that you can... My point is, where do you, or did you, and can you go in the future to do that kind of an act in and around France or the world? What kind of venues book you for that?
Yeah, the funny thing about the KISS act is when I went to the French Championship of Magic with it, I have never performed it before, and no one has ever seen it.
Wow.
No one. I was living in a small apartment at that time. I was having a regular job, and so I was working like, you know, full time at that job, and the rest of my time, whenever I was done eating, I was cleaning my kitchen table, and mm-hmm. I just put all my cards on the kitchen table. And for like 3 years, I worked on the act, and I showed it to no one. And I was very nervous when I came to the convention.
Well, yeah, I bet you were.
Because I was like, it's different. No one has seen it. I got no advice from anyone. And will they understand what I'm talking about? Will they get the story? I mean, am I good enough, like, in my acting and miming and everything, so they know what I'm talking without talking? So it was just weird. But it worked It worked amazing. Then I did the Macmillan convention in London. That's where I met Obi O'Brien, by the way. That's when he saw me first time. He judged me. I didn't know him. And he invited me to my first ProRef in 1997, before FISM. And then it was FISM, obviously. And then I started to do the act, like, mainly in festivals and conventions and galas and close-up. And so, but the interesting thing about that act is because it's I don't need anybody to pick a card. I don't need any spectator on stage with me. It's to music and it's completely choreographed. It's like a mini stage. That's always I call it my my close-up mat is like my stage to me, and my hands are like the magicians and the you know, the choreography that you would see on the stage act, and it's. And that's pretty much the same to me. So that's why I got booked quite quickly and now almost all the time to do it on stage. So I've done the Kiss act for, like, you know, audiences of like 3,000 people.
Now, when you're doing that, obviously they have a camera and a big screen, right? Exactly.
Yeah, camera and big screen. Now, the good thing is that every theater now, like back in the day, was you had some, but not everywhere. Now you got, you know, video projector and screen everywhere. So, and like most of the time now, this is how I perform the act. And Butterfly and the Kiss, I am just on that stage and the camera guy comes and then just have this big screen on stage and they can see me live performing it on that screen. And it works really well because, again, it's like a choreography of my hands with the cards and the music and the story. So, and it's something unusual because most of the time people have like a show and they're like, okay, so we have the Dove act, we have the manipulation act, we got the illusion, we got this and that. They want to have something in the middle of that that's different, especially if they've done the festival for like 10 years or 15 and they are trying always to bring something,
you know, a variety.
Like new, yeah, variety or like new or they have not had before. Or maybe I would say a little bit more sometimes like modern because suddenly people are thinking, wow, okay, we are going to see those little cards in his hand, like, you know, very high on that very big screen. So, and then suddenly they're like, wow, that's going to be hard for him because if he's just, you know, if he's pretending to have one card, but there are two, I mean, and it's not perfectly squared, we will see that on the screen, like huge, like it was like, you know, 3 feet away of distance, you know, between the two, while it's only 1 millimeter in reality. And so, I mean, there is also this challenge of having my hands, I would say, scrutinized by an audience of like hundreds and thousands of people sometimes looking at that very big screen and me doing my thing and to music. But it works really well. I mean, there is something about that act that I cannot explain, but I mean, it's every time I was in the same show sometime as some guys and they were like illusionists and they came like 4 hours before me and they were building those boxes and stuff and I just arrived with my deck of cards in my pocket and I left after and they had like still 2 or 3 hours to unscrew all everything and put everything back in the flight case in the truck. And in the end, I didn't get much less applause than him and sometimes it was maybe a little more. And I'm like, okay, well, fair enough. I mean, just chose that way.
I'd heard that about Henry Evans when he was touring through China, that he was just he was just universally loved by the whole country, even though other people were doing larger things, and he just had the deck of cards, you know.
Exactly. I mean, Henry is just a perfect example because he's got just such amazing, nice personality, and his magic is just absolutely incredible. So. And the fact people now, I mean, we live in a generation of screens now. We get screens everywhere between our tablets and phone and TV and stuff. So now we got like all this Netflix stuff. So we spend even more time anywhere, everywhere with like screens of all different sizes. So it's not, I mean, I remember in the past people were like, okay, people are just leaving home not to watch TV. It's not to sit in a theater and watch a screen. So I used to hear that. And honestly, I don't really hear that anymore now because like screens are everywhere and just the fact that they are seeing someone live on stage doing something which is not easy, close up, manipulation, sleight of hand and everything choreographed and they can see that live on a giant screen knowing that that guy cannot do any mistake because we'll see it like so big. And then it's just another way to enjoy an act, of course. I like better when it's direct, when they're like
Sure.
Like, it performed in Paris at the Double Fond. It's like a small theater. I love it. People are very close, and the emotion is easier to convey rather than through a screen. But
well, I think another thing that you're able to do, of course, is to do something that does not require any language, so you can work anywhere in the world, and that's something that Marvin Roy, Mr. Electric, has always said, that if you can do something that is a silent act, you can work anywhere, anytime.
Exactly.
And the fact that this is something that would be on YouTube or it can be recorded and people have seen, and so it's still it's not the mystery, although that's part of it certainly, but it's also the emotion, and that you can feel that on the screen when you're watching that through YouTube, but they still want to experience that personal, which is why that you're, I'm assuming you've had this act stolen by others, but it's still, it's, yes. There's no one who is you. It's just like there's no one but Matt Kang. There was no one but Harry Houdini, but although several have tried to steal bits or all of their acts. And so even if they can watch that, study that, there's still nobody who's going to be Boris Wilde. And so people and companies still in conventions and television stations want to book you and have you do this live for them so that way they can experience this personally and live.
Yeah, exactly. You're absolutely this act, and whenever you do something that becomes successful, obviously you get you know, people stealing or ripping you off, and that act, the Kiss act. I mean, I have I think 5 or 6 different videos from people in Armenia, India, and Peru, and China, and like doing the act. Some did the Kiss act on national television, like in Some Things Got Talent, you know, prime time, and I was like, I was shocked, obviously.
Wow.
But honestly,
and nothing you can do about it either, really.
Well, it's
you can write them.
Yeah, whenever you know about it, it's been done. So of course, it's like somebody like I'm lucky to have friends all over the world. So whenever someone has like seeing that on TV, is like, oh, Boris, God, okay, I got that video for you. You have to check that. I'm so sorry. And then I get the information, of course, after it's been aired, and I'm like, oh crap. All right. And then, I have to take care of it because there's no way you can let that, you know, go. Otherwise, everybody would think, oh, yeah, it's fine. I mean, everybody can do anything as long as, you know, you don't get caught. No, it doesn't work that way in magic or in anything. You should not do that. But yeah, so I got, I got legal stuff for that. But nobody, I mean, I've seen them all, like, you know, copying that stuff. And it's not because it's me or my baby, but I didn't feel the emotion because they were, it's not their baby. It's not something that they put all their heart in. It's something that, you know, they tried to reproduce. And it's difficult to put emotion in something like that, obviously. So.
Yeah, because there again, it's your story, not their story. You know, talking, I remember with Jonathan Pendragon years ago when he had the illusion interlude made for him, that he felt that when he and Charlotte were doing that, that it was more than just an illusion where one body is passing through another. But he was trying to convey the emotion and the feeling that the two of us are one and that one is coming out of the other. I mean, you know, there was a lot more to that behind the scenes rather than people just looking at it. Wow, how did his body go through her, you know, in that illusion. And several other people have done that because he and I had talked about this, I believe on a podcast some years ago. And he was saying just that others are just doing it as a trick and not as an emotional piece that we had developed this.
Exactly. And sometimes like people would just see the two same illusions and they would just prefer one, or they would feel something more about one. They might not know sometime why. But it's because the performer just put something personal and something unique in it that may not be seen but felt, or just processed by your brain, or it could be subconscious, it can be subliminal. But for some reason, you will show the two same illusions, and like 99% of people will be like, oh, I like this one better. And you'll be like, it's exactly the same presentation, same illusion. Yeah, but they did something special on that illusion that everybody maybe not saw this way, felt.
You know, that's interesting point. I was just thinking about David Blaine, for an example, that whenever that he had come on the scene by doing not just magic on television, but he always had something that was the big thing he did, whether it was escape from a block of ice or from top of a pole or et cetera, There were, I mean, he's really more of a sensationalist rather than a magician, as some might have said that. But the point is there were others who were doing and who are doing more dangerous types of What would I call those kinds of stunts? Yeah, they are stunts, mm-hmm. but they are an endurance stunt. And mm-hmm. so it was. There are other people who do endurance stunts, whether it's Buried Alive or whatever. But why is it that he had that niche and that he found universal acceptance and television popularity, mm-hmm. and these other people, Joe Blow and whomever, you know, who you'd never heard of, have been doing these things, but just didn't get the notoriety. You know, I often wonder, why is it that this guy did and this guy didn't?
Yeah, well, I think David Blaine is a good example because, yeah, speaking about emotion, you could see whether in the preparation of these stunts and when he was there and afterwards. I mean, everything that was around the stunt has been made so you feel for him. You just mm-hmm. that's the thing. I mean, sometimes, as you said earlier, you know that guy would not die on stage with his straitjacket and the spikes and stuff. And no. But in David Blaine's case, so you don't feel for the guy. You're like, oh, he's doing his job. But yeah, he's very high. There is fire underneath him. So if he's falling, I mean, he's gonna get burned, obviously. But it would be fine. But when you see David Blaine's, you know, what he did, and you're like, oh wow, okay, well, if it was me, how can I would never survive that. I mean, I could not even stay there for 3 minutes, and then, or you try to, you know, hold your breath for, and then you just I can't. I mean, how can he do that? And so I think he just managed to find a way so people really feel for him and just in a so engaging way that you're like, okay, so it's, right. Yes, it's so strong.
Well, now you had developed, again, we talked about back in the late 90s, the KISS Act and then later the Butterfly Act, which it was, explain the Butterfly Act also.
Butterfly Act was an interesting process too, because the KISS Act has been really successful, more than I ever thought, and I mm-hmm. just performed it a lot. I got lots of requests to perform it over and over again, and I love it, and I always said I will stop doing the KISS Act the day I don't feel anything anymore while I'm performing it. Mm-hmm. So, and it could be one night, it could be tomorrow night I do it, I don't feel anything, that's it, it's over, I would never do it again. So I was doing it a lot, but at the same time I was like, okay, I would like to do something. I would like to have another act now, and especially having people say, would you come back to our festival, to our convention, to the show? And we love the KISS Act so much. I'm sure you got other stuff. And I'm like, yes, I have. But the KISS Act is such a unique and special piece that I want to come back with something which is as good as that. So it was just difficult, and I got two solutions. Either I would do something, again, completely different than the KISS Act, or I would do something in the same spirit of the KISS Act, but trying to be, you know, a little different and stronger. And I chose that option because I was like, well, I got this image now of this little Frenchie, the little French guy with his kisses and, you know, romantic, and I got this image of the... the French thing.
Romantic.
And I'm like, mm-hmm. romantic. And I'm like, well, I just built that image for years and years now. And maybe destroying that image suddenly by doing an act to, AC/DC music or something. I mean, I don't know if it's wise or if it's smart from you. I mean, it's great because you can show another facet of you, but at the same time, you're like, okay. And so I chose the other option, but it was the most difficult option because doing something completely different was the easiest option. I mean, it's there's lots of things I could do, but keeping in the same track of the KISS Act, but still being romantic, but being different and mm-hmm. not redoing the KISS Act again. It's that's why I said it's a sequel. I said I did something in magic that few people do, but lots of people do in the movie industry. They do sequels. And sometimes in the movies, the sequel is not really good or is not as good as the first
That's
one.
True.
There are a few exceptions, but most of the time it's not as good. So that was a trap and it was difficult. And that's why it took me five years for the Butterfly Act. And the Butterfly Act is about lost love. So basically I introduce it as, if you've seen the KISS Act, about love story, people meet for each other and fall in love with each other. And the Butterfly Act is what happens after. So not right after the kiss and they say, I love you, because that would not be a family show anymore.
Mm-hmm.
but 10 years later, things have passed, things have happened, time has passed, c'est la vie, as we say in French. And people start to understand it's not going to be as, you know, rainbow and unicorn as the Kiss Act. And then from the beginning, they understand that it's about lost love. And I'm talking about Butterfly, which is, of course, also some kind of analogy. And there is a frame with a picture of the, you know, of the same person that was in the Kiss Act. And I'm playing with those cards and with the butterflies, and basically there's lots of things happening, and I'm playing more with the cards itself. So cards are moving on the mat. They are turning into black butterflies, like some kind of like moth. And at the end, I got all the cards are turning into that frame that just disappeared, that the picture that disappeared from the frame, which is now black and white and not in picture. So we understand about that. And like the black butterflies, it's not black anymore. There's cutouts in the cards, and there's still hope at the end. It's like, you know, ever someone is lost, mm-hmm. or you, it's not with you anymore, there is still hope that you can, you know, that this love it's still in you forever. And there's this butterfly coming back in color at the end, like flapping its wings.
It's good that you leave hope head. Open.
Yes, I really mm-hmm. wanted, because I was afraid. I wanted to do something a little darker, because I also listened to criticism, and some people really loved the Kiss song. Some of them thought it was like a little too, I wouldn't say cheesy, but like a little too romantic for them, because, you know, they're not the kind of people who just like comedy, like rom-com, romantic comedy, etc.
Yeah, too so sweet, like, too saccharine.
Too sweet, exactly. So I was like, yeah, and also for me, I mean, it's been more than 10 years, and I'm like, ah. Okay, I grew up also, I got
That's true, you're more mature, you're older, and that life does move on, and things work out, sometimes they don't, and this way that it is another chapter, and so mm-hmm. that is just the natural progression of things.
Exactly, so, and that's why I think the Butterfly Act worked so well, because I, first it was the first kiss, everybody can remember first kiss, second was about lost love, everybody has just lost someone, like either somebody passed away or somebody just, you know, broke up, or, you know, somebody just, you know, left for the other, to the other end of the world for, mm-hmm. you know, there with their family or whatever. So
does this mean that there's going to be like a third act? I mean, it feels incomplete right now, you know, everything should be in threes.
I'm not planning. Yeah, I know it's usually things work in like a trilogy. I'm not planning to do a third act. I mean, I don't know, unless I get, you know, I wake up tomorrow morning and I'll be like, oh, damn, I have that. But it's, I don't really know what to do after that, because it's, it has to be something different. I mean, and I have explored, I think, pretty much everything I wanted to do in terms of music, emotion, and cons with those two acts. Mm-hmm. So I might go somewhere else, I think. But it's
well, you could go to someplace else that wouldn't involve the cards, but it could really, again, complete the trilogy.
Wait, I mean, I thought about this. Maybe it could be on stage. Maybe I can just move on stage now and do like something on stage which is in the same spirit, so people will recognize my style and the French touch, I would say.
Now, what do you have to do when you're performing the Butterfly Act? Do you have to first of all do the Kiss Act so they kind of get where you are, rather than jumping into that, or is that separate?
No, it's separate. So yes, I mean, I really created a Butterfly Act, so people who just, you know, may have seen the Kiss Act before will, you know, and pretty much get it. Even if it was like a long time ago, they haven't seen it. But I also wanted to make sure that if people see the butterfly for the first time, and they see the Butterfly Act, I mean, they can jump into it. So I took the same strategy, I would say, than for movies, because I love movies, mm-hmm. and I there are lots of movies. Like the number two, if you miss number one, you've never seen, you go to see number two, you're not lost. I mean, you just.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Of course,
sure.
People who saw the number one are more familiar with some of the characters, and they will laugh at some jokes that, you know, because it's a reference to something in the first one. But people who just haven't seen the first one still get.
It's pretty much like James Bond. You know, you can jump into any one of the shows and they're independently great. You don't have to know the character of what he had done in previous episodes, because they've got a new villain or whatever else.
Yeah.
Although they're all sequels.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, gotcha. Well, mm-hmm. Boris, thanks very much. This has been just phenomenal, and that some great advice, and I hope that you pointed some people in some new directions, and maybe given some good food for thought for people to perhaps come up with some other new ideas for our future FISM in 2022, I guess, which is going to then be in Quebec, and they'll be having mm-hmm. the Continental championships leading up to that beforehand. So, perhaps people can be inspired by you to also not have to, in your case, even though you haven't performed this before anywhere, you may be a Grand Prix winner for the first time also, your first time out. It has been done. You're proof of that. So congratulations, and thank you, my friend. I appreciate that a lot. Before we close, because the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word, I always like to close by asking my guests what it is that is their philosophy of life. What is it? It doesn't have to be a word. It can be, a phrase or something that you live by that is your motto or your philosophy. When you wake up in the morning, what gets you going?
I would say we talked about lots of emotions, and so I think you should be guided by what you feel is going to be the best to do in life. I mean, it's about feeling. So sometimes you have to rationalize things, or you have to look around and see, oh yeah, if I do that, I will make more money by doing this. But then you build some kind of little strategy. I mean, you have to, if you're a professional, and especially if it's what makes you, you know, if you make a living with that. But I would say that, you know, follow your feelings, follow what you feel. Like when I did the Kiss Act the first time, I had no idea. I didn't say it to anyone. I just had a feeling that it would work because it was different, and people would feel something strong saying it.
And you believed in yourself.
And I believed in it. So feel the things. Yeah. Sometimes people will say, no, don't do that. No. But inside, deep inside of you, you feel it's the right time or it's the right thing to do. I would say go for it and just follow your feelings. Because even if you screw up or even if you don't succeed, it's fine. I mean, you at least you tried. And you followed what you felt was, you know, the best thing or the right thing to do at that moment. So you have no regret later. You cannot regret anything because that was the best thing to do, to follow what you felt.
Better to live and love than never to have loved at all. Kind of
exactly.
A quote.
Yes. Yeah. That's it.
Yeah. Well, Boris, again, thank you very much. It's been just enlightening and always a joy to get a chance to chat with you, and always look forward to each time we get a chance personally to meet each other over at a convention somewhere. And because I know you travel about, you know, quite a bit, and looking forward to the future then as well. And good luck to you. And thanks again. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Scott. Merci beaucoup.
Love that. So with the Magic Word Podcast, that was Boris Wild. This is Scotty out. Thank you, Boris, again for being my guest this week on the Magic Word Podcast. I appreciate you taking the time and sharing your thoughts and experiences. This has been really great. And I know that all the rest of the listeners have enjoyed that as well. To keep up to date on what's going to be going on at the Magic Word Podcast from week to week, make sure that you subscribe to our pod letter. If you just go to themagicwordpodcast.com, there you will see an opportunity to join the pod letter. There should be a little pop-up that you can fill out, put in your email, and there you go. Nothing to it. And then each week we'll send you an update as to who's going to be on from week to week and who's coming up the next week with suggestions from the archives as well. So until next week, stay well, get booked, and remember to just go for it. Follow your feelings so you have no regrets for at least trying whatever that you want to accomplish. This is Scotty out.